How do you want to proceed?
This is really the administration's time to...
Annie, why don't you ask whom, I think both Stacy and Gail are online, it shows here, so if you want, you can ask either one of them any questions or ask them how you want to proceed.
Well, Ms. Voigtlander, are you available to describe the tort considerations of the current version of the bill?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Gail Voigtlander. I'm the supervising attorney for the torts section for the Civil Division Department of Law. We have serious concerns about the scope of the liability that would be imposed under the current amendment and under some of the proposed amendments that the sponsor has with her today. I think that Assistant Attorney General Carpinetti gave kind of the broader brush policy conflict, which is that both under statutes affecting children who are adjudicated delinquent, as well as statutes having to do with children in need of aid, the law is looking toward placement in the least restrictive setting in order to further rehabilitation for those who are adjudicated delinquent and to help best rehabilitate children who are in need of aid, who have been removed from oftentimes incredibly damaging atmospheres at home. I'd like to first describe, when you use the term state custody, that includes quite a penumbra of situations. It includes children who may have initially been removed from their home, but under federal laws that affect certain of these children, have to be returned to the home for a trial setting in the home with supervision to see if that would work out. So although they are in state custody, they are in the actual day-to-day care and custody of their parents. They also might be placed with a relative, so that in their day-to-day care and custody, they are with relatives, although they are technically in state custody. They may be in foster care with foster parents licensed to provide care on a day-to-day basis. They may be children in group homes. They may be in private institutions. And then, of course, under DJJ, there may be in one of the state's youth facilities. So when you use the term state custody, you are including all those people, and actually you're also including for those who have been adjudicated delinquent. They may be on supervised probation by Division of Juvenile Justice, but again, return to their parents for the day-to-day living situation, care, and custody. So all of those are within the term state custody. If you then look to the numbers, you know, what kind of numbers are we talking about? If you include all those children who are in state custody, then I think from working with both OCS and DJJ, we came up with a total of approximately 2,500 children who would fit that description. And so under the existing amendment, then you are exposing the state to potential liability of up to that $15,000 for property damage for 2,500 children and their actions. So that is the current amendment that's reflected in version O of the bill. Also, the way this is worded, it's quite probable that in addition to the state responding directly to third-party claims, there also could be payments that are made by insurance companies on behalf of their insured parents, who then would come attempt to recoup or subrogate the monies that they paid on the homeowner's policy from the state so that they would be able to walk away. Although they have been paid the homeowner's premiums, they have a contractual right to subrogation. And so they would also have at least a leg in the door to try to recoup those from the state under version 0.1 of the amendment. The second amendment, 0.2, which would provide all children in state custody, but limit it to those children where parental rights, both parents' rights have been terminated. We think that that's about somewhere between 225 and 250 children that would be affected. So again, the state would have liability up to $15,000 for that group of children, and he still, under that version of the amendment, would have issues of insurers seeking to recoup the monies they have paid back from the state. So in fact, the state would end up, if the insurers were successful, being the guarantors of the insurers. The third amendment, 0.3, we'll call for purposes of this discussion, removes the amendment that was imposed last week, I believe, and reflected in version O, and takes it back to the status quo in terms of the state from the way the law has been. And that means that victims of property damage look to the children themselves who have committed the property damage, look to insurance, look to the parents of the children who have committed property damage. But the victims cannot look to the state or to foster parents or runaway shelters or any or guardians, any of that group, which the current law protects and says that you cannot make the claim. So resulting losses would be the fiscal impact to the state would be twofold. One would be that, and this is reflected in Department of Law's fiscal note for torts and workers' comp component. My section combines both functions, but for our purposes, we're just talking about the tort component. And that reflects additional personnel costs to defend claims as they arise. If it's inappropriate for the person to proceed against the state or these claims, which we anticipate from insurers. So it reflects attorney and paralegal support and their overhead costs. That does not reflect actually the payments then that would have to be made if the state is made liable. The payments would be reflected either through risk management funding or in a judgment bill, or I think the fiscal note also points out could be from the catastrophic fund. So even if you, under the current version, said the state has exposure for 2,500 or so children who are in state custody, and only, if you conservatively estimate that only 5 to 10% of those children would generate such claims at a potential payout of $15,000, we're talking some very serious money that the state would be liable for under that version. I believe that those are the overall issues. There had been concern, and it's reflected in the previous fiscal note submitted by law, which has now been corrected, that it appeared, and perhaps because we were working from previous drafts like W, it appeared that the state also, by the amendment, was being made liable for restitution in juvenile adjudication cases for crimes against persons. And that posed even more issues that conflicted with certain states' immunities put the Department of Law in conflict situations, and also was unlimited exposure. After working through the bill on the O version and working with the sponsor, it appears that that was never the intent, and it appears that the glitch that we saw perhaps was in trying to match up amendments to previous versions. So at this point, we are operating on the premise that the state is not liable for crimes against persons that are adjudicated by delinquents. With that, I can answer any questions the committee may have, or if there's other issues that Assistant Attorney General Carpinetti thinks I should address.
Any questions from panel members? Senator Guest.
It's not a question, but I wanted to clarify something. It is the case that if a child is in state's custody, but the rights, parental rights haven't been terminated, that under the bill, the parents would still have a liability. It is not the case that if the parental rights have been terminated, that the parents would have a liability. So in those cases with a property damage, if the child doesn't have a parent, if the parental rights have been terminated, that $15,000 cannot be recouped from the parents. It cannot be recouped from the juvenile for equal protection reasons. So that $15,000, if a child doesn't have a parent, that $15,000 cannot be recouped. So I just wanted to clarify that. It is the case if it's under state custody, but if parental rights have been terminated, then it's a different case. And so I just wanted to clarify that for the committee. And again, just to go over the amendments again, because I know they've been handed out. Amendment number one is the language we had pulled, asked to be written, that is simple states liability, but cleans up the last amendment, because there were some issues that the committee caught on the last amendment. Amendment number two is states liability, but only after parental rights have been terminated. And amendment number three removes all the state liability and goes back to the original form before the committee made that request. So those are the three amendments. It is a balance between, again, it's about this whole bill is a balance. It's a balance between accountability and it's a balance between restitution. So Senator Dyson and I leave it to the committee, since it was the committee's desire to go this direction. We are the most comfortable with Amendment 2. We think it's the most appropriate when the state has actually terminated parental rights, then liability kicks in versus other situations. But we really do feel like this is a good committee and we'll go whatever direction the committee wants to go.
My questions, comments at this point? I know, you know, I appreciate the fact that the state would like to put minors in a position where, in the least restrictive setting. However, you know, if that's the Tasmanian devil that we're turning loose in a least restrictive setting, you know, I wonder about how responsible that is to society. And if we say, you know, well, we've taken this child away from the parent, well, we're going to put him in a least restrictive setting, and hopefully there's no liability to the state if we do that. So let's take a shot at this. And I understand that the counselors say that that's sometimes the best way for a child to head towards normalcy, if you want to call it that. But at the same time, you know, I have to be responsive to the people out there that say, well, why didn't someone, you know, indicate that this child was the Tasmanian devil? And so that's kind of where I am. I don't have a problem at this point looking at this from a standpoint of parental responsibility. It appears to me, though, if the child's a runaway, there's no responsibility on the parent's part. So there's this big black hole out there that I'd like to see closed. I mean, if when you take a child away from the parent, they still have responsibility. But if they run away, they don't. You know, I'm having a little problem understanding that. Just, Senator Guess?
On the runaway situation?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, that was language that was worked out 4 years ago.
I know.
But with Senator Dyson and Senate Hess on. So it has more of a historical, and we decided not to change it. And it is the case, I mean, it was a policy call at that time by the legislature to say we weren't going to hold parents liable if a child has run away. So, again, this is a new legislature, and we can address that situation. But yeah, it's not new statute, it's old statute.
So if I got a problem child, every time they leave the house, I'm going to report them as a runaway. But then I'm okay. Go ahead, Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought it would be instructive to provide you with the description of what kind of damages are occurring for kids in state's custody.
I'd like to know that. You anticipated my question.
Okay, good. Between the Office of Children's Services and the Division of Juvenile Justice, we had about 2,500 kids in state's custody in fiscal year 05. The damages that those kids caused, about 24 kids had committed damages while they were in state custody, whether it was to foster parents' home, a residential placement, or a juvenile facility. Those damages totaled about $21,000. About 10,000 of them were in juvenile facilities, and the other 11,000 were in those other OCS placements. Not one of the damages that we were able to find in FY05 was over not one individual bit of damage was over $5,000. Most of them were in the hundreds of dollars. A couple of them were in the $3,000 or so range. What happened with those cases was the state paid for paid for the damages. If the juvenile committed the damages in a facility, the youth was brought to court in order to pay the restitution on the damages they've caused. Often when the juvenile does damage to a facility, they will asked to work off in a sort of community work service sort of way the damages that they did. In addition to paying the restitution, they'll work with the maintenance staff to repair the damage that they made. I'm not sure how this amendment will change that, because the damages have tended to be under $5,000. The state's worked with the juvenile to get the damages repaired. I'm not sure how that's why I wanted Ms. Voigtlander to go first, because the liability questions about civil, I think, are the bigger monetary issues for the state. I don't know how this would change, either amendment would change the way we manage those cases when they occur in our facilities, but that points to the concern about the overall bill that we've had is if we're going to divide liability between the juvenile, if a juvenile is in a facility and they commit, say, $3,000 worth of damages, this bill says the juvenile is liable to pay that, not the state. The state can't participate. If the juvenile has no means, and obviously in a facility, they can't earn some money to repay those damages, we're concerned that takes longer for the restitution to be repaid. So the concerns about the bill for us remain with that breakdown between $5,000 paid by juvenile, the next $15,000 paid by the parent or the custodial agent, whether it's the state or the juvenile, and the juvenile responsible for the rest.
Mr. Chair, can I just respond and clarify? And it is a complicated bill, but it is the case within the bill that the victim, and in this case would be the state, always has the ability to waive restitution. So if the state wanted to waive restitution and come up with some alternative plan, that's allowed in this bill. It is not so strict that you can't, but instead of having, in this case, the state or court make that judgment, it's the victim saying, okay, I'll waive restitution and I'll work it out. So in response to the department, I think they would still be able to handle those cases the exact same way that they handle them now.
Through the chair, it would be helpful to understand how then, if the damages are over $5,000, how that breakdown occurs when the state is both the victim and the prosecutor,
right?
Because the juvenile is in a facility. I guess as victim we have the right to waive the restitution. As the prosecutor, I'm not sure that's the responsible thing to do. So it sets up a conflict between being both the prosecuting body and the victim of the damages.
Mm-hmm. Senator French.
Just a question, I guess, on some of the numbers I've heard so far this morning. I just thought I heard Ms. Tony say that of the 2,500 kids that are in some kind of state custody, about 24 of them have committed acts of vandalism last year. Is that
right?
Right.
Right.
So 1%.
24 in DJJ.
24 between DJJ and OCS.
But I thought when Ms. Voigtlander was sort of giving us her background, she said that if the truancy or vandalism rate was somewhere between 5% and 10%, you could get enormous numbers of claims. And I guess I don't know if you've had a conversation with Ms. Voigtlander or if she's, you know, just sort of throwing numbers out, but it struck me that that was, when she said 5% to 10%, I wrote it down because it struck me as being unreasonably high. And now I've learned that it seems as if it is unreasonably high, that, that the actual number of crimes committed by kids in state custody, by crimes I mean acts of vandalism, is fairly low. And I guess maybe I'd ask Ms. Voigtlander to respond and see if she wants to make an adjustment to her estimates based on the evidence we've just heard here in the hearing.
Ms. Voigtlander, was that meant to be a scientific estimate or was it to be a ceiling?
Through the chair and members of the committee, Senator French, unfortunately, I think what Tony's speaking about is one very small component of the exposure that this bill makes. What he is confining those numbers to are DJJ kids who are actually in a state youth facility, which is a lockdown situation, and OCS kids, but the only OCS kids and the only claims that that $21,000 reflect would be claims that are brought informally by a foster parent who has that child in their placement for property damage. And there is a regulation, 7 AAC 53 110, I believe is the citation, that caps property damage that foster parents can request from the department and the state to reimburse at $5,000. It also has several other limitations. For example, if the homeowner does have a policy of insurance, then they, under the regulation, are to get that property damage covered by their insurance rather than coming to the state. So that's why those numbers are so low, because they do not reflect third-party claims, such as claims by a school district that a school district might make if one of these 2,500 children who are in state custody vandalize a school or vandalize a neighbor's house. This is only that $21,000 is reflective of a very narrow group, which is those who are actually locked down in DJJ custody and those who are in state custody through OCS in a foster home and did damage to the foster home, which the foster parent has asked us to compensate up to the $5,000 limit of the regulation when they are not otherwise covered by insurance. So that is the difference between the exposure that this bill creates versus the very narrow data that we have, because in under existing law, we're only talking about what Tony's talking about is damage to a state facility by a juvenile delinquent who is in one of those facilities, or the OCS numbers only reflect those claims by foster parents when a child, you know, puts a hole in the sheetrock or has problems and, you know, tears up a couch or something of that nature. So that's what the difference is. It is not an inflation of the numbers I'm saying, it's the numbers that I'm totaling, saying that 5% to 10% of the total of 2,500 and exposure for third-party claims, which we have not had, is a far greater number than that $21,000 would suggest or reflect the 24 kids, because none of that reflects third-party claims.
And just to follow
up. Go ahead, Senator French.
Just to follow up, Ms. Voigtlander, I guess I just still have to ask again how you derive a 5 to 10%, I guess I'll call it a vandalism rate, for those 2,500 kids.
That's a conservative estimate based upon the fact that, kind of going back to what Ms. Carpinetti testified to, the children who are in state custody, if they're in for delinquency, then there are obviously behavior issues. But if they're in as children in need of aid, they also tend to have behavioral and oftentimes very extreme and serious behavioral issues. So it wouldn't be like taking 2,500 children from the general population. You're already dealing with a population who, by and large, exhibits anywhere from mild behavioral misconduct to extreme behavioral misconduct.
I can appreciate that it's a population at risk and a for lack of a better word, say a damaged population, but I guess I'm just not quite getting where your data comes from. Is this from police reports? Is it from a Department of Law study? Is it, I mean, are you just sort of assessing this group via a thumbnail sketch that they're going to be 5 to 10% vandals?
Through the chair, Senator French, in order to make an attempt at deriving fiscal notes, we have had to basically, I think as you describe it and as Senator Seekins, Chair Seekins described it, it is making a roughshod estimate, knowing that this is a very severely at-risk population generally, that you are going to have third-party claims of some nature from 5 to 10%. But it is not based upon reviewing police reports or other statistical data. It's simply knowing the population we're talking about with working with risk management in terms of trying to assess claims exposure and that's how we conservatively estimated a 5 to 10%, but it is not based on looking at property damage statistics.
Well, if indeed the property damage comes up to that 125 to 250 times a year that exceed $20,000, then we have a much larger problem than I'm aware of. If that's a serious risk, if that's what the actuarial risk is, between 5 to 10% of that 2,500 young people are going to cause damage every year in excess of $20,000 or greater than $5,000 and up to $20,000, then the problem is much greater in terms of behavior than I've ever heard, that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to that. When you're talking about the types of property damage, I think most of these losses traditionally are covered by insurance, because people's property, when you're talking those kind of numbers, tend to be insured types of things. There are a car, and someone, you know, a juvenile steals the car. Your cars generally are insured. They do damage to another person's home, then generally those are insured assets. So I think that perhaps that's part of the reason that you don't see, you know, you're not seeing it, but the day-to-day claims managers, I think, for homeowner policies and vehicle insurers would see that those kinds of losses. What we tend to see, because it draws the most attention, are the large losses, such as those, you know, that the Anchorage School District has sustained when entire playground facilities have been destroyed through vandalism or windows at construction sites, those kinds of things.
Okay, any do you have, did you want Ms. Steinberg to present something, or is she?
She's available for questions about the collections fiscal note.
Collections, okay. All right, let's, I think we have basically several decisions that we need to take a look at as a committee. And that is, at what point, the first one, I believe, at some point, we believe that the state should be held responsible on the same level as a natural parent would be. Am I correct on that? We're kind of informal here. But at what point now? That's the next step, in my opinion. And by the way, I need to introduce my probation officer back there. I mean, my wife. For those who don't know, my wife, Connie, sitting back here in the audience. The first point is at what point? And we'll throw that on the table for discussion at this point. Certainly, I believe we should go to at least to the point where parental rights have been terminated. We want to go to the south of that a little farther. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't here for some of the testimony this morning. I must admit it makes me a bit nervous that the state in some instances is convenient, more vulnerable to collecting money from potentially, or rolls over quicker, or whatever the case may be. And I believe in the business of accountability, and if the state is a responsible party, I guess at some point, then we have to make sure that the state holds up its end of the bargain. But in the same token, not make available the deep pockets of the state all too often, too convenient for a system that can be very exploitative.
I agree. A couple questions I have. When the state, let's say I'm a foster parent. One question I have is, to be a foster parent, am I required to obtain and maintain a liability policy on the actions of the foster child?
I'm sorry, I don't know that. I will find out. I don't know.
This is Gail Voigtlander. If I believe I know the answer, if I may respond.
Okay, go ahead.
Chairman Seekins, the OCS has not required foster parents to have have a homeowner policy, nor a liability policy. I think because OCS has made the policy call that it is difficult recruiting foster parents as it is, and we do have some foster parents who live in apartments or rent houses, and so they don't necessarily have a homeowner's policy. But statistically, you would generally find that of those who are in a home which they own, because they have a mortgage for it, then they are required by their mortgage to have a homeowner's policy. But the department has made the policy decision that they do not require it.
Now, most homeowners have a policy that does cover the replacement of the collateral, but they're not necessarily required by their mortgage holder to have a liability policy.
Mr. Chair, oddly enough, many homeowner policies, and this is an area where I only know a tip of the iceberg, and perhaps if Brad Thompson is there from risk management, he's more familiar with a standard homeowner policy. But oftentimes it covers not just the asset, but it does have general liability, and it does provide coverage for negligent acts that result in personal injury to people, and has far more coverage than just the asset itself, just the homeowner. It includes the type of liabilities that the homeowner may have.
I agree. Most insurance salesmen sell you everything they can. So what I'm looking at is, where's the black hole? I know that a lot of times renter policies also have liability plans that go along with them. And so if you're renting an apartment, you have a renter policy, you probably have liability coverage as well. And the intent here is not to try to find, I agree with Senator Huggins. We don't want the state to be the easy cash cow. But at the same time, I'm trying to take a look and say, okay, what liability is there? What protection is there for the general public whose property is damaged by, and then who then should that liability attach to after the first $5,000? And there's got to be a point with a juvenile, with an underage child, that someone has that attached liability. That's my belief. I'm struggling with that a little bit. Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, back to the foster parents, but maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear the answer in the case of a foster parent, who is liable? Not whether the insurance company is liable. Maybe the person said it, but who is liable?
Mr. Chair.
At this point, it would be the parent, right?
Well, I don't know.
No, Mr. Chair, it depends on how the state decided to deal with that case and whether it was adjudicated in criminal court, if it went through the informal process, or it went through civil court. And each of them has a different liability structure at this point. Under this bill and under the First Amendment that cleans it up, it would be the state's liability. Under the Second Amendment, if the parental rights hadn't been terminated, it would be the parent's responsibility.
Parental rights not terminated goes to parent.
Right. Yeah, if a child, and that's the Second Amendment, and the one that I think Senator Dyson and I are most comfortable with, is if the parental rights have not been terminated, the parent is still, accountable for that child, even if they're in state's custody.
And just for a moment of clarity, when we say parent, we mean foster parent.
No,
oh.
I'm sorry.
Parent.
Yeah. Natural parent. Parent.
So if
natural
my child parent. Has been taken from me, put into a foster home, mm-hmm. He goes out and burns a house down,
mm-hmm.
I could be living in a different state. Child 5,000, me 15,000, child the rest.
Right.
That would, Mr. Chair, to Senator French, yeah, that would be under the Second Amendment. On that situation, and the logic behind that one is, in those situations, families are trying to get back together. That parent has still said, they still have that responsibility, even if that child has been taken away from them in custody. And they're still trying to actively, be in that child's life, and that means being responsible as well. And so that was the logic on making the cutoff point at the termination of parents. But in none of the three amendments in front of you would the foster parent be liable.
It's if the parental rights have been terminated, then it would be child, state child, in a foster home.
Correct.
Right. I'm making a little chart.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
Senator Huggins.
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I'm having a hard time figuring out if the child is with foster parents, parental custody or rights are still in place, but you don't have any control, but yet you're liable as the biological parent.
Mr. Chair, maybe the department or someone with more, I'm explaining to you the logic of the Second Amendment, but maybe someone who knows more about the system can answer, those situations.
Have a volunteer.
This is Gail Voigtlander, if I may respond.
Come on up. Pull up a chair there.
Chairman Steakins, members of the committee.
Sure, go ahead.
If I'm understanding Senator Huggins, what he's grappling with, this bill.
Just pull up another chair there.
That portion of AS 3450.020A, which does say damages for which parents are liable shall be apportioned by the court between the parents without regard to legal custody, but with due consideration for the actual care and custody of the minor provided by the parent.
Okay.
So that's a factor that the court considers. If, for example, you could have a situation where the parents are in the process of divorcing, perhaps, and you have one parent who has physical custody, care and custody of the teenager, excuse me, and the other natural parent is actually residing outside, and while they still have their parental rights, they are not doing the care and custody day to day. That's a factor that the court would take into consideration.
Senator French?
For the statute.
But Ms. Voigtlander, that's just as between two parents, neither of whom has physical custody. The court would say, well, which of you is closer to the child, which of you is more involved in the life of the child, which of you was, you know, riding the child more, or whatever, just, you know, process the court goes through. But nevertheless, those parents, or if there's only one parent, there's going to be no apportionment whatsoever. They're still on the hook for $15,000 worth of damages.
Through the chair, Senator French, it's a factor that the court would take into account,
right,
whether
apportionment.
The parents have actual care and custody. So the court would balance that in determining whether either parent would have to be liable for that $15,000 slip that it's provided. So it would still be a factor that the court would be considering. If I'm reading the revisions, they don't change that language, which exists in the current law, that the court gives due consideration, as the statute says, to who actually has care and custody of the child.
Okay, thank you. Sir, you'll introduce yourself for the record. We're eager to hear.
Brad Thompson, Director, Division of Risk Management. Gail and I work closely, and we have discussed this, but I thought maybe I'd bring a little different approach to this. This statute has been reformed a couple times, back in 95 and then in 03. In 95, paragraph A was reformed to increase not just the limit, but to also clarify that the actual care and custody of the minor was required for the parent to be held strictly liable. This statute creates strict liability for parents. Then two up to 10, and it has been a massage to now greater numbers. But you don't go into the, was it reasonable, you know, you're just stuck as a parent. But they added the condition that you had to have actual care and custody, which is frankly the state's concern in paragraph B. Paragraph B in the past has protected both the state and anyone providing foster care or housing for these children that have been either removed or for their own safekeeping or because of their criminal acts. But thus far, we've had no claim history because we've had the protection of the third-party claim. But there is, in the administrative code, a method for the foster parent to come to the Department of Health and Social Services for the modest, and I'll read just real quickly, administrative code, it says modest damages and loss costs are normal in the care of children and are included in the standard rate. However, the division will, in its discretion, reimburse a foster parent for damages and loss up to $5,000 under the following circumstances. And one of the conditions in order for a foster parent, this is the only group today under the law that has a remedy for damage to personal property, as a foster parent, if they were providing adequate supervision and exercised appropriate precaution and something happened to their personal property, it wasn't otherwise insured or there's a deductible or whatever the situation is, the agency has been making that remedy to the foster parent. As a additional benefit to them because of the services they perform. This would go away.
Clarity, that's where a foster child damages the foster parent's property.
Correct.
But what if the foster child damages the neighbor's property?
There is no remedy against either the foster parent or the state today. This is proposing that the state,
to change,
depending on how you, as a policy, I say you as a group, address the question of the legal custody of the state. Is it the whole universe of 2,500 children, or is it only those that have had their parental rights removed to be 225, whatever that population is, then the state would be, I believe, as proposed, responsible for damages excess of the first $5,000 for the next $15,000 layer. So it would be 15,000 X of 5 in any single occurrence. That today is likely insured by that neighbor and or that other property owner. People make decisions to protect their assets because of either obligations of a mortgage or just the asset. You assume the risk entirely if you don't protect yourself from, and quite frankly, vandalism occurs and we don't know who does it. These are the cases where we may be able to identify who did it, and if it indeed is a kid that is in legal custody of the state but is really in back with that same family or a relative, is it fair or to propose that the state should pay for that? Those state kids would become, if you had four kids performing an act and one was in legal custody of the state, that would be the target kid to go for as an insurer of the homeowner's policy next door.
Questions?
I think.
Fully disagree.
Yeah. The so my question is, what's your experience on losses that you've seen, or that where claims were made?
To the chair, we actually have had notices of incidents, but because of this existing statute, we have had no response to them. It's okay. Been rare, but there have been losses involving foster parents' property, to include the alleged arson to a building under construction that was uninsured, and it was several, or potentially a couple hundred thousand dollars. But again, because of this existing statute, we made no remedy because there was no obligation. The agency did pay the $5,000 limit under the administrative code.
The questions at the moment? Let's take about a 3-minute recess. We're back on the record. We're going to hold this bill over until tomorrow so that we can proceed with some of the other stuff we have on our agenda and get some clarifications from Senator Guest working with the state people, and we'll have a little bit better opportunity to discuss it knowledgeably tomorrow. So with that, thank you very much for being here this morning, and we're going to move to our next agenda item, Senate Bill 237. And who's going to represent the state on this one for us this morning? Susan? Ms. Parks, welcome back to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you. It's nice to be here as always.
And if you know the drill.
Yes. For the record, my name is Susan Parks. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. The Attorney General had hoped to be available this morning to testify. He may have been on telephonically earlier. I assume he's not still on, just double-checking.
I haven't seen him.
Okay. He had hoped to be here to testify briefly, I think in essence to take responsibility for this bill. I will make a few comments. Part of Attorney General Marcus's goal as Attorney General has been to go around the state and visit all 13 of the offices, criminal and civil division, and in doing so, we've also been meeting with the judges around the state. And this bill was prompted by the Attorney General visiting various places in the state, Kenai, Anchorage, Palmer, talking to judges, talking to the DAs, and learning about the heavy caseloads that were being faced, particularly in the criminal division, and how slowly cases seem to be moving and seem to be backlogged. He was so struck by this that he came back and shared that information with Chief of Staff Jim Clark, met with Scott Nordstrand, who supervises OPA and the public defender, met with the court system and discussed what really is a problem for all of us. We normally are only focused on our little piece of the criminal justice puzzle, but this was an instance where he felt we all needed to come together. The result of those meetings with the court system is the bill that you have before you, and it's a proposal to add 4 additional Superior Court judges around the state, 2 in Anchorage, 1 in Kenai, 1 in Palmer. And as the introductory comments in the bill suggest, in large part it's because of the criminal caseload backlog. And the purpose and intent of the bill is to help move those cases along for the good of victims, for the good of the public, for the good of the court system. And I'm here to testify in support of this bill, and I appreciate having the opportunity to testify in support of the bill. I've been doing this work for almost 20 years. I've seen the changes in how criminal cases are processed, and I've seen the complexity of the system increase. What I'd like to do is just briefly talk about a few sort of intangibles that generally have been affecting the system overall, that have slowed down criminal cases in general, and then talk specifically about the areas where we've proposed additional judges. Bob Linton, the Anchorage District Attorney, is online, I believe, and is available to talk in more detail about Anchorage, so I'll just be real brief about Anchorage. Then I'll talk a little bit about the numbers.
Probably should check to see if anybody on the committee is interested about anything happening in Anchorage.
Deeply.
Oh, okay. All right, go ahead, Ms. Parks.
Thank you, Senator French. And then I'll talk about the numbers, because the numbers are up, but I do think it's important to keep in mind the intangibles that are really very difficult to measure, but I think we all know inherently are affecting the way cases get processed. I think the first thing is cases are simply more complex than they ever used to be, and DNA is an excellent example. 20 years ago, there's very little DNA work being done, and we like to refer to it as a CSI effect. Now you're seeing more and more cases where DNA is part of the case, and it's not just sexual assaults, it's not just homicides. We've solved burglaries with DNA, and when you get more of this kind of technology and this kind of lab work in cases, that makes the case more complex. It delays the ability to go forward because you're waiting for lab results. The defense then often wants to send that out to their labs to be tested. That creates delays. You're going to have expert testimony, expert notice. You may have pretrial motions that you wouldn't have had before the technology. This has affected the workload and slowed down cases. Drug driving cases are another good example of how cases are just more complex. We've litigated the breathalyzer. We've litigated the intoximeter. We know what the legal limit of somebody driving under the influence of alcohol is. With drug driving, those cases are just more complex. We've got new kinds of expert witnesses, the drug DREs, drug recognition experts. Their qualifications, their ability to testify in court are being litigated now. We have to send, we can't just have somebody blow into a machine and know what the level of their blood alcohol is. We've got to send blood out to a lab, wait for results. The other side may want to have those results tested by their own expert. Again, creating more pretrial work, more motion work, more complex cases, and it slows the system down. I could talk about the computer cases we're seeing now, the white collar cases, meth labs, much more complex than your typical possession of cocaine case. The number of items that are taken into evidence, the complexity of how that evidence has to be bagged and tagged and dealt with in court just increases how long it takes these cases to get to trial. Victims' rights have significantly impacted cases as well. Alaska's come a long way, and I think should be really proud of what we've done to involve victims in cases. And I don't mean this as a negative, but the reality is it slows cases down. Prosecutors used to be able to have complete control. Victims were sometimes an annoyance that we had to talk with occasionally to explain why we did what we were going to do. We don't treat them that way anymore, and we shouldn't, but it does slow things down. When you talk to a defense attorney and you want to make an agreement to resolve a case, you can't just set a court hearing. You've got to set up a meeting with the victim and talk to him about it, and that's appropriate. Victims have a right to be notified of hearings and have a right to be heard in hearings. That's happening daily across the state, but it takes time, and it impacts. And all these little things, I think, have worked together to kind of slow the process down for the right reasons, but it impacts the cases. We've had an increase in the types of crimes that we have, increase in felonies. This legislature has created new felonies over the years that has increased the Superior Court caseload, again, putting pressure on our court system to be able to process the number of cases. What the situation we have now across the state is what we call a trailing calendar. In Superior Court, there are more cases than can be tried, and everybody recognizes that, and the majority of cases resolve, but we have what's called a trailing calendar, and Mr. Linton will talk about it in Anchorage particularly, but you have dozens of cases set for trial a week. Everybody knows those cases can't all go, but the pressure builds up, and unless you have judges ready and available to take those cases to trial, they don't resolve, and you continue with this buildup, slowing down the processing of cases and resolving these cases for victims. The numbers are pretty significant. Since 1995, we've seen a 64% increase in felony referrals statewide. During that same period, we've only seen a 15% increase in misdemeanor referrals. So the felony caseload is really up around the state over the last 10 years. And I think we all know that we have not had a 64% increase in the number of Superior Court judges in the court system. Just recently, even, we've had increases. Just between 2004 and 2005, we've had an increase of 386 felony referrals. I think also significantly, our petitions to revoke probation, felony probation revocations have to be handled by Superior Court judges. Those are up as well. In the last year, we've had an increase of 148 cases. In looking at the request and where the bill would place judges, Palmer is the number one priority. Palmer, I think everybody is aware, has just had a population explosion in the valley, and with that has come a crime explosion. And I think the materials you have, several articles that talk about the pressure that has come in the valley, but the case referrals in the valley have really been dramatic. In 2002, we had 595 felony referrals. In 2005, it was up to 869 referrals. That's a pretty dramatic increase. And the types of cases significantly impact the workload as well. When I talk about caseloads in offices and people want to just talk numbers, you can't just talk strictly numbers. As I like to say, a couple of run-of-the-mill theft cases don't take the kind of resources and time that, say, a sexual assault case takes or a sexual abuse of a minor case takes. And I think you have to look at that. And in looking at Palmer, I think we have to take into account the meth lab situation out there. It used to be that they were known for their marijuana grows. Well, now they're getting known for their meth labs. And I think, again, the materials you have, and I won't repeat what you've got, the troopers' reports talk about the number of meth labs that they're finding out in the valley and the significant impact that's having. I think it's also significant also that in 2005 of the referrals, 12 of them were for homicides. That's a significant number of homicides for an area the size of the valley. So 12 homicide referrals and 4 referrals for manslaughter or negligent homicide. Again, those are the kind of cases that take significant resources. that usually take a year or two to go to trial. That's the kind of caseload that Palmer has. In looking at their trailing calendar, they currently have right now set for trial in the system 161 felony cases, and Palmer has two Superior Court judges. Not this week, but that's, you know, within the next 120 days, which is typically when the calendar is set for. And they've only got two Superior Court judges to try those cases. And keeping in mind these judges can only try criminal cases part-time because they've got their Child in Need of Aid caseload, their civil caseload. And as your materials indicate, Palmer is so overloaded at this point that they're doing night court. The DA's office hasn't been involved in that. We've resisted asking our employees to work nights, so they're doing traffic court. They're doing small claims kind of cases, cases that actually I think for the community it's helpful for some folks who don't have to take time off for work, but I think it just shows the kind of pressure that's on the court system out in Palmer.
Ms. Parks, if I might, could you give us a baseline of the number of judges as they exist, Palmer, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I know that Palmer has two Superior Court judges total. Kenai has two Superior Court judges total. I'd have to defer to Mr. Christensen on Anchorage. I know that they've got three Superior Court judges doing full-time criminal work in Anchorage. I'm not sure what the total number of Superior Court judges are.
Chris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. In Anchorage, we currently have 13 Superior Court judges, and we actually, at this time, we now have a full four judges assigned to the felony caseload. Anchorage is the only court that has enough judges that they can actually specialize. Every other court location, including Fairbanks, a judge does everything. In Anchorage, we have the advantage of the efficiency of being able to assign some to domestic relations, some to criminal. It is a much more efficient way to do it.
Yeah, I would just project that I would, you know, obviously have some vested interest in the Palmer area, know a little bit more about that. But given the case that you made, whether one is adequate or we'll be back next year looking for another, and if that is what we're looking at, it appears to me that there would be some wisdom to potentially plus in that one to a higher number. To anyway, I just project that out. Don't answer it yet. Think about it.
Thank you. Well,
sorry.
And through the chair, I think Mr. Christensen can probably talk. I can talk about the criminal caseload. Obviously, when you've got judges doing a variety of cases, there's other pressure on their time, and Mr. Christensen can probably speak to that. Regarding Anchorage, again, Mr. Linton's online, and I'll defer to him for the most part. But again, the trailing calendar in Anchorage, Mr. Linton has been keeping track over a period of years and can talk to you about how it's built up. But again, they have over 300 cases pending trial, four judges to try all these cases. In 2005, they had 2,559 felony referrals. Of those, 17 were homicide cases, five were manslaughter and negligent homicide cases. So again, those are a significant number of cases. Those are the kind of cases that normally don't plead out, go to trial, and put a real strain on the system. Finally, Kenai is another area where the caseload has grown, where there's two judges to handle the entire caseload, Superior Court caseload. In 2002, we had 477 felony referrals. This last year, it was up to 539. They've also seen a significant increase in the number of petitions to revoke probation. This last year, it was 190. And again, Kenai last year had three homicides and five manslaughter and criminal negligent homicide cases referred. They seem to get those unfortunate driving cases on the Seward Highway, which seem to go to trial. Again, in Kenai, they've got a trailing caseload, 167 cases pending trial down there in Superior Court right now. And I think something that Mr. Christensen and I were talking about, another thing that can impact different areas of the state is really the relationship between the bar. there are certain areas of the state where it seems like there's hardly ever any trials where defense and prosecution seem to work things out, and there are other areas where there's some animosity or there's just a different way of doing business. And for example, Kenai is an area where it seems like a lot of cases go to trial, so there's more pressure on the court system. Cases don't seem to resolve quite as quickly. Palmer also has seen that kind of pressure. In fact, I was working last night preparing my comments, and I had an email from the Palmer DA who indicated to me that there was a trend now where the defense bar was not going to be waiving their speedy trial rights at all. They were all starting to demand their trial within 120 days, and there was real concern about what the court system was going to be able to do. They were talking about picking juries for numerous trials just to stop the Rule 45 from running, to get a jury picked within the speedy trial time, and then, you know, do the trials one after another. So again, those relationships can put pressure on the system. If everybody wanted a trial, I think the system would collapse. So just in summary, I think the public is better served by efficient system of justice. This requires that there be court time available to meet the needs of all the cases. Most cases don't go to trial, but unless there's a threat of a trial, these cases don't resolve, they won't settle. So I'd ask you to give consideration to this bill, and I thank you for your time and attention. I'm available for any questions.
Questions, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Parsons. Over breakfast this morning, we were having a conversation about judges, and you know, there were some concerns voiced, quality of people, and then just the motivation to do that task. And now that's one part. The other part, though, is, well, I don't know, I'll talk about Palmer because I know a little bit about Palmer. If we gave one or more judges to Palmer, is it academic because of the space we have? I know we're doing some rejuvenation there. Or does an additional judge really make a difference because we have the space to accommodate more judge activities with multiple chambers and scheduling?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, my understanding is that this legislature did appropriate money last year to add courtrooms to Palmer, right, and that's going to be happening, and that would accommodate the additional Superior Court judge. I'll defer to Mr.
Go ahead, Chris. Mr.
Chairman. The Palmer Courthouse was originally built with three courtrooms. And two courtrooms were added onto it about 6 or 7 years ago. Last year, the legislature appropriated the money to add two more courtrooms onto it. These two, right now, Palmer is short about two courtrooms. They've converted various space in the building to be able to be used as hearing rooms by magistrates. We have started night court because of the shortage of courtrooms. And we have done night court with things that don't involve the Department of Law because we don't like to force other state agencies to send their employees in on off hours. You know, we do small claims cases and traffic cases, as Ms. Parks noted. The problem we have with Palmer is that, well, we have two problems. First of all, we just opened our bids for this two-court expansion, and because of the high cost of steel and oil, the bids are well in excess of the money the legislature appropriated last year. This is something we're going to have to deal with in the next few weeks. The other problem is we have now maxed out the size of that lot. We cannot make that courthouse any bigger. But we will have room in that courthouse for the current number of judges and for this new judge. Now, the population in the valley has increased dramatically. It was about 5,000 people at the time of statehood. Now it's 75,000 people, and over the last 3 years it's been increasing at about three times the rate of anywhere else in the state. But that population is moving away from Palmer and up the Parks Highway. And I suspect something we've already had informal discussions about with the Department of Law, with corrections, with public safety, is that eventually we're probably going to have to open a court up in that area, in the Wasilla area. The thoughts are it could be an annex to the Palmer Courthouse, maybe a traffic court. Probably it's going to have to be a whole separate court with its own judges. And eventually, we may, if we're lucky, we will build a joint facility, a facility that has all the justice agencies in it, including corrections, which will save the state a great deal of money. That's probably a few years.
Our concept of a justice center that we've been talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Chris, I appreciate you sharing that, because I share your sentiment, particularly the latter part of it. As a demographic shift happens, it just doesn't make any sense to the commute it takes to get to a place that artificially represents how it used to be. And, you know, and a number of people are asking that question, and recently, I guess, we've recognized that in that there's a new trooper facility that's going out kind of in my backyard, but on the most dangerous segment of road in the state.
But, and if I may, just one more thing. Palmer right now has the highest Superior Court caseload per Superior Court judge.
Right.
And if we add this judge, it will still have the highest caseload
yeah.
per Superior Court judge. So, yes, they do need more resources. There will not be the space for them. We'll be talking about more space in a few years, I think.
Right. Well, go ahead. Keep going. If I might, Mr. Chair. Chris, in plain English, if we gave Palmer two judges, would it be academic because only one judge would be able, one additional judge would be able to function? Or is that a stretch?
Through the chair, I would have to talk with our administrative people who handle the space. I think it's a stretch, in part because we not only have those judges out there, but we are still sending an Anchorage judge to Palmer a couple of weeks a month. I'm not sure, since we're already running a night court, I'm not sure what we could do. And if we could do something, it would have to be with the consent of the other justice agencies. We'd have to negotiate something, because it would be the kind of court, after hours court, that would involve the Department of Law. It would have to be more than small claims court and everything else. We can check on the possibilities.
Senator Gass?
Thank you. To follow up on what Senator Huggins had said, could we actually expand in the bill to recognize the needs of the MATSU area and have two, and then one doesn't get filled until we have space? I mean, I actually agree. I'm not sure why we're going to do a bill when we're going to come back and do a bill and we're not meeting the needs that we have. So it seems as if the most efficient thing would be ensure that this bill meets the needs. And is it possible to say, okay, to go to Palmer, and recognizing that we won't be able to hire that second judge until we have space?
Chair, it's possible. Sometimes you can acquire additional space fairly quickly, and sometimes it might be 3 or 4 years down the road. For example, if we did the Justice Center out the road, that would be a big project. And so I'm not really sure if it would make sense to do that right now. I would like to check with folks back in Anchorage on that.
And we are talking about trying to look at different places around the state to work on a Justice Center complex where we would have, you know, everything from troopers to courts to prison space available, all in a single location, so that we could, have a whole lot better interaction between those state agencies that are involved in the justice process.
That's a good idea, Ms. Chair. Chris, are there any other areas, well, the areas that are indicated in the bill, Anchorage, Palmer, and Kenai, with these increases, are we going to meet current needs, let alone future needs? You already said Palmer, we won't. We'll still have the highest court, the caseload. How about in Anchorage and Kenai?
Through the chair. Mr. Chairman, I was going to make some general remarks about each location. In Anchorage currently has, well, let me start with Kenai. Kenai currently has the second highest Superior Court caseload per judge in the state. If we add a judge there, if we had all four judges, that would drop them down a bit to about the sixth highest caseload. So that would certainly take care of their needs long term. Anchorage has is tied for the third highest caseload in the state. And if we were to add these two judges, it would be, I think, in fourth place or fifth place. It would probably meet their immediate needs. Palmer is the one that is going to continue to have needs out into the future as long as the valley keeps growing. You know, the Kenai area had the greatest growth after Palmer from about 1980 until about 1995 or 2000, and then it has slowed way down. You know, Kenai is manageable, but the valley shows no sign of stopping. In fact, the projections are that within 5 years, the valley may have as many people as the Fairbanks area has today.
I'd like to, in the discussion, I plan on introducing an amendment to add one more judge to the Fairbanks district, to the 4th district. I've warned everybody, so I know you guys know it's coming. And primarily, I do spend a lot of time talking with the judges in the Fairbanks area, and the presiding judge, Nisa Steinkruger, known her since our kids were little because they all went to school together. So she's a good source of information for me as I'm looking at how we can meet the needs in the interior as well. So I plan on proposing an amendment to add one to the Fairbanks, and I don't think that there's any lack of support from the members of the committee here that I would detect for what your request is. So, you know, and I know we can go on with the rationalization for the request, but I don't think it's necessary. I would bet. I haven't found out yet, but and I know you've got a great presentation, the rest of it prepared for us, but you probably have support without having to do it. And on the floor, they always tell us, when you got the votes, vote, don't talk. So, Senator Guess?
Yes, I just had two more questions. I was trying to understand the statistics in the back, and don't really, so I'll just ask the question, what's going on in Southeast? Because in some places in the back, it looks like these great increases in Wrangell and Sitka, and other places it looks like there's a decline. And so we just haven't addressed Southeast, so if someone could address, is it growing? Does it have enough judges now? Does it not, but it's not as bad as Palmer, so we're not dealing with it in this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, Southeast has not had the sort of population growth that you've seen in other parts of the state. There have been some areas that have really not grown at all in many, many years. And the only place in Southeast that has some issues is Juneau. Juneau actually has about the third highest Superior Court caseload per judge in the state. One of the advantages Juneau has, Ms. Parks has already talked a little bit about, you know, some of the things that actually drive the caseload. Not, you know, the raw numbers are a little bit deceptive. You can play with them any way you want. There are some things that really cause problems. One is, for example, while they have a very high caseload per judge here, the number of cases that actually go to trial is a lot more manageable than other places, and that's where a judge spends most of his or her time. Then you go to Fairbanks, on the other hand, and you'll find you will have as many jury trials in a year almost as you have in Anchorage. Even though the caseload per judge is a lot lower, the judges are spending a lot more time on the bench. So one issue with Juneau, of course, is there would be no place to put another judge.
Yeah. But if we're discussing the need for judges versus the space for judges, I didn't understand from the presentation whether or not there was a need in Southeast for another judge if we put space issues aside, which I know you have to think about both, but.
Through the chair, if I could just respond. Part of, again, for the Department of Law's impetus in sort of getting this rolling was feedback from judges and from DAs, and I have not heard the complaints in Southeast about we can't get our cases to trial, and it's been 3 years and this homicide still hasn't gone to trial. And I think part of it is they're most cases are resolved. And there also is, it seems to be a good working relationship with the prosecution and the defense bar in Southeast. It just seems like there's good relations. The caseload has gone up, criminal referrals. I can tell you, for example, Juneau, in 2002, there were 263 felony referrals. In 2005, it was 414. So the referrals are up, the caseload is up, but they do seem to be managing.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I had one more question.
Senator Grass.
Since Senator Tirio had to step out the room, I'll ask what he would ask, which is, do you really need the findings and intent language in the bill? I see on number B you might, but since we're putting it in statute, it just is
we normally don't
legal.
Normally this is the committee that cuts out the findings and intent.
Well, through the chair, Senator Guess, in looking at proposing this bill, the impetus really was the criminal caseload. But once you give judges to the court system, you really can't control what they do with them. And so the purpose behind the findings were to make it clear what the legislative intent and what was really kind of driving the desire and sort of an urging to the court system to make use of these resources in assisting with getting the criminal caseload. And that's why they're there.
Yeah, oh, I understand. Sometimes we'll substitute it with a letter of intent that we'll attach to the bill rather than cluttering up the statutes with the intent of just changing the existing numbers.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's up to this body, right, how they want to convey that message, but we're hoping that message gets conveyed to the court
sure.
system.
Well, let's do this, if we could. Senator French,
thanks.
I know
just,
you had your
just
hand up.
Briefly. Of course, I'm supportive. The last time I was spending much time in court was 2002. The Anchorage courthouses were very busy then. I have no doubt that they're much busier now. And from our testimony, we know that Palmer's busier yet. So I'm, you know, I think like most of us, we're ready to see the bill go on. I guess I would just, it just occurred to me as I sat here looking at the rather hefty fiscal note that comes along with this, we all know it's going to cost a lot of money. It may be helpful for your cause to be able to compare, you know, not only our state now to what our state was 5 years ago, but our state to other states, and to know, you know, how do we compare to other states with similar populations and similar crime rates? If there is such a comparison, it might be, sort of serve to allay some fears that, you know, maybe we're just not getting the job done. I feel strongly that we are. I don't think there's ever been any indication that we're not, but it's just a random suggestion. Thank you.
Okay. First, I think, Senator Guest, the chair would entertain a motion to remove the findings and intent.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to remove section one of the bill and ask that we
craft a letter of intent.
Craft a letter of findings and intent.
Okay. Is there objection? Hearing none, that'll be amendment number one. Amendment number two, I'll let the clerk kick the chap there. Amendment number two, the chair will propose, and that amendment will be conceptual, and we'll bring it back into final form. But conceptual, it adds one additional Superior Court judge to the 4th Judicial District at Fairbanks and adjusts all the numbers. The chair proposes that amendment. Is there an objection to that amendment? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. I know you've got Mr. Linton and Mr. Cohen is online. I don't think that their testimony is particularly necessary. We're pushing the hour. Gentlemen, I know you've been online, but I hope you won't be insulted if I tell you your testimony is probably not necessary this morning.
No offense, Dave.
Thank you very much. I think other than this, the chair's ready to have this bill move from committee on the will of the committee.
Mr. Chair, before we do that, can I get some assurance from the administration that they're going to get back to us in the future committee about adding the Palmer? Because I actually agree with
yeah.
Senator Huggins.
I
think we should in this bill
like
and deal with this space.
Yeah. Why don't we get this amendment and we'll just move it on net tomorrow?
Yeah.
You want to do that?
Yeah.
Well, it depends. Mr. Christensen, when are we going to have some feedback from you on if we increase
Palmer 2?
Palmer to two.
I will get working on that today.
If we do this again in the morning, we can talk with you in the morning, maybe?
I can try. I can certainly try.
Let's see what we can do. Okay. Well, let's hold this bill over till tomorrow then. I think we'll finish up with that. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee this morning, what we're going to do is tomorrow we have two bills that we've already looked at that we'll have on the calendar, and we have item number three that we didn't get to that we'll look on the calendar. And then we'll try to work through the rest of the calendar. Assault on school employees, bus drivers, et cetera. Thank you very much. This it's now 10:23, 24, and we'll adjourn.